All right, gang, are we ready? Everybody here? Más o menos? All right, Proverbs 30. We'll revisit 30 again. Verse 17. So be sure to depress all of you first thing on a Friday morning. You're welcome. 30:17. Somebody read that. There's a character quality spoken of here that is not one any of us should wish to have. Tasty. The eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother. What is this speaking of? An individual who mocks their father and scorns their mother. Yeah, rebellious. Rebellion against authority. The inability to submit to those in authority above you. Shay, Nye, Jared, and Brad all had the privilege of sitting underneath a guy named Tommy Nelson. In Texas. He is the pastor of Denton Bible Church. The program that you guys are currently sitting in was formed by the one that he started years ago. And he told a story when we were in his program about the season when he was going through seminary. He was the chaplain for Louisville High School football, right? If you think football is a big deal in Clovis, it is a religion in Texas. I mean, it is a big deal, like off the charts, dumb big deal. Anyway, his team that he was chaplaining for was really, really good. They lost in the state championship like the previous year, and they had a guy on their team that was a senior the year that my pastor was chaplaining for them that was unbelievable. He was one of only four guys in the state of Texas that had been a four-time All-American, freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior year. He was ridiculous. He was a running back, was so good that literally he had his pick of the litter in terms of where he wanted to go to college, anywhere he wanted to go. Great. Just God had made this guy to run the football. He was amazing. And as he was picking his schools, he ends up going to USC. And he was going to come out here to replace a guy by the name of Ricky Bell, who was like the, I think, the Heisman runner-up sometime in the early 80s. Great running back. And they were going to groom this guy underneath kind of Ricky Bell, and then he would ultimately replace him as a starting running back for USC. So our pastor asked the head coach of Louisville High School, hey, tell me what you think. What's this guy going to be like? Is he going to set records? Is he going to be that big a deal? And he looked at our pastor and said, he will never ever carry the football. He said, what do you mean? Like, this guy is unbelievable. Why won't that be the case? And he realized, because of this guy's greatness, he had to placate, the head coach did, to a character issue in this young man that nobody got to see, and he had to kind of work his way around it. So long story short, this kid gets to USC. He ends up playing there for a little bit, never touches the football in a game, quits USC, returns to Texas, goes to East Texas State University, leads a rebellion against the coach, tries to shoot the coach with a shotgun, gets dismissed, obviously, from that team, goes to Kilgore Junior College, as you can imagine. Kilgore is like this really small town in between small towns in Texas that you just kind of drive through, and if you blink, you miss it. Goes out there, quits that team, then ends up with an opportunity to go try out for SMU, has a confrontation with a coach on that place as well and gets kicked off as well. So he's been to four colleges. This kid got kicked off two teams, and he quit two teams. He was so good that the Cowboys gave him an open tryout. Like, hey, he's never touched a ball in a game, but he was just that talented that the Cowboys gave him a tryout. He didn't make in the team. And our pastor said last he heard from him, he was living in a common law marriage, quit his job, and was suing his employer for not paying his disability or whatever it was. And the guy was just basically a lost cause that was kind of floating through life. And with the coach that worked with this kid in high school, this was the quality that he saw in this kid, the inability to submit to authority. And he realized he will never, ever make it in this world because this was the character quality that kind of dominated his life. He did not have the ability to submit to authority. Now, like it or not, God puts all of us in those types of situations. We, males, females, young, old, it doesn't matter where you're at. Everybody in this world at some point has to submit to authority, right? We had to do it growing up underneath parents. Most of us didn't like it. None of us inherently enjoy submitting to authority, right? We're not wired that way. By the way, who was the greatest of all examples of people who hated to submit to authority and wanted to be like the one whose authority he wouldn't submit to? Satan, right? That's why God kicked him out of heaven. I want to be like God. I will. We're children of the world. We're born underneath him. We're born of the fall. We do not like that quality as well. Regardless of your station in life, whether you are CEO of a great company or you are somewhere on down the pecking order, you're going to have to learn to submit to authority. Okay, it's going to happen. I run a nonprofit, and I have a board over me. My kids always tell me, "Dad, you can do whatever you want. Like you're in charge of your nonprofit. Like they think I'm a big deal." I'm like, "No, I have a board that I still have to submit to an authority that is above me that makes decisions, and they can fire me tomorrow if they want to." Right. So regardless of where it is, that's a quality that we need to all be aware of, and it will speak doom in your life if you can't do it. Okay, guys, what happens, by the way, if God gives you a bride and you do not have the ability to submit to authority prior to marriage? What happens in marriage to a man that is given authority but yet can't submit to authority? What type of guy will that be? You're going to get one of two extremes. Dogmatic. You're going to get a dogmatic, I tell you to jump, you tell me how high type leader who doesn't know how to rightly handle authority and will abuse authority. Or you're going to get the other extreme. Passive, let the wife lead. I don't know how to lead. I don't know what authority looks like. Both of those are horribly unhealthy, okay? Ladies, as you think about marriage as single women, watch that guy and watch how he submits to authority. Will he submit to the authority of his father? Will he submit to the authority of his boss? How does he interact on teams? Is he a team player? Is he someone who's humble? Does he need the spotlight? Does he need his name in the paper? Does he need credit? Those are great qualities to look for. Because if he won't submit to the earthly authority, he's certainly not going to submit to the heavenly authority, as he's called to bend his knee to Christ, and then you ultimately to follow him and that family, okay? Guys, what happens, by the way, if you get a woman in marriage who doesn't know how to submit to authority, who wouldn't submit to her father, who wouldn't submit to bosses, who wouldn't submit to any authority placed over her, what are you going to do in marriage when you're trying to make hard decisions and you're asking her to trust you as you're following Christ and submitting to him and allow yourself to lead her? What ultimately is going to happen in that situation?
A man cave?
Oh. You're going to go to a man cave. That's exactly what you're going to do, right? Are you going to arm wrestle her and say, "Hey, okay, now I win, now you submit to me," and you, right? You're stuck, okay? If a lady won't submit to a guy in marriage and that type of relationship, the marriage is doomed because he can't lead. She's ultimately calling the shots because she's not going to submit to authority. So whether you're male or female, whether you're single or married, this issue is paramount. And this was the issue that literally wrecked this kid's life, that caused him to be ultimately a whole lot of nothing because he couldn't do it, okay? I don't know about your wirings and your personalities. This is a hard one for me. I struggle with this as a person who likes freedom. I like to be able to call the shots. I like what I like, right? And sometimes I don't like when other people disagree with me because I'm always right, right? And that doesn't work real well in life and in marriage. So if you're like me and struggle with that, and you have tendencies, bents in that direction, if you will, remember that. Okay? It's a quality that we all need to learn how to embrace, and it's a good thing, and ultimately for our benefit. Okay. So, thoughts on that?
What's your dad? So you're saying this is
something. I bet you can guess.
Are you persister?
You think?
Persister
achiever, 100%, 98, and it drops off dramatically after that. So. Dramatically, yeah. So that is my wiring. And by the way, the residency program tends to attract persister achievers. If you guys know what we're talking about, the Your Unique Design. If you haven't taken that test, it's a great one. It's one that we use often when we hire staff here. It's a personality test. It's a 6 characteristic profile test. And instead of saying you're a golden retriever or you're a otter or you're a whatever. It does a much better job of saying, no, you're a blend of these things, you're a mix. It's similar to maybe like the Myers-Briggs, if you guys have taken that one. It's just a test that we use frequently around here in common language, okay? So, there you are. Cool? Any other thoughts? That really doesn't count as a thought, Hillary, because you asked a question, so I don't count that as a thought yet. So, there are still no thoughts after Proverbs. But there may have been one that one day, so. All right. Yes.
You see this early on, like that close kid, and I'm seeing it, and I'm dealing with it. How do you approach that?
I mean, ultimately, it's a heart issue, right? I mean, that is deep down, that's a heart level issue. I even look at my kids, and I can see that some of them are much more apt to listen and submit and be teachable. And man, I got other kids that are a whole lot more like me. that don't want to do that. So at least in my family context with my girls, we try to steer their hearts and help them understand the value of that, and that we're for them, and that this isn't some power trip or whatever. But that ultimately is going to come with trust and them submitting at a heart level. But that's the hard part, because you can't change a heart like that. That ultimately is that's a rebellion issue inside, which may be down the road a rebellion to God, rebellion to other things. But there's a sense of I'm going to do life my way, and they're either going to submit on their own, or God's going to put them in a headlock and get them to submit. And that usually involves various degrees of pain. So I don't know. That's at least been my experience in my home. That's a hard one. So, okay. I'll tell you what. I would never hire someone that couldn't do that. I wouldn't bring them anywhere near my staff. They'll ruin a staff. I would never marry somebody. I would never advise a gal to marry a guy who couldn't do that. It's a disaster. So if you see that, ladies, run for the hills. And guys, if you see that, same thing. And it's just not, it's going to breed unhealth on so many levels. So anyway, for what it's worth. Okay. Back to Genesis, shall we? Judson, will you pray for us this morning, my friend?
Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time that we get to come together and get into your word. And I just pray through the heart of everybody in this room, God, that we will be humbly submitted, and that we'll learn to submit to the authorities in our lives. And thank you for this time in your name.
Amen. All right. So speaking of submit, we got Jacob, and he is now out of the house. He's been booted, if you will, back home. Rebecca, and Isaac have now sent him off to Padan Aram to go to Uncle Laban's house. He's about to go to school in this discipleship program for the next 20 years, and he's going to learn from the one guy that can out-trick the trickster how life really works. So we're going to pick up on his story. We're going to watch kind of his journey. We finished, the end of 28 last week? How about yesterday? 28 yesterday. 29 now. We'll see now Jacob's beginnings and his meeting of Rachel. Okay, before we jump into that, I want to just kind of point you to this chart. This is in Dropbox, by the way. But we're about to start talking about a grip of kids and wives and concubines and the 12 tribes that are coming from Jacob. I just wanted you guys to see a bit of a visual. So you can see up at the top, we've got Abraham. Those that are in blue are kind of the line that's going to get tracked through Genesis. You've obviously got Abraham, you got Isaac, then Jacob, who we're studying now, and then ultimately the handoff is going to go to Judah, and then kind of I gave Joseph a bit of a kind of an and also, okay? Jacob is now going to have 13 kids from four different women, two wives and two concubines, and that's the story we're about to pick up on. It gets confusing fast trying to keep up with all these names, so I'll point out the ones that are most important, if you will, but just want you guys to be aware of them and not get lost in the minutiae of names if these are new to you, okay? So in Dropbox, if you want to pull up on your handy-dandy device or what have you, or just kind of reference up here and we'll talk about it, okay? So chapter 29 now, we've got Jacob in Padan Aram in Haran, okay? And now he is going to meet, or attempting now to meet with his family. So we've seen God bless him, meet him. You remember Led Zeppelin yesterday, we studied Stairway to Heaven. God met him in the wilderness. God has assured him that he is there. Jacob has made his conditional arrangement with God. If you, then I. So we'll see how God does carrying out his part of the bargain here. So 29:1, let's pick up there. Ooh. Hello, Peter. 29:1. All right, this almost sounds like Abimelech rolling into Rebekah's hometown, trying to find a bride for his servant Isaac. So here comes Jacob, rolls into town, sees flocks being watered. Verse 3, all the flocks were gathered there, then they would roll a stone over the mouth of the well to keep people from stealing, obviously, their water. Verse 4, Jacob approaches these people and says, "My brothers, where are you from?" And they said, "We are from Haran." And he said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor? Do you know my family members? Okay, do you know my uncle?" And he said to them, is it well with him? So verse 5, they say, yes, we do know him. And he said, is it well with them? It is well, and here is Rachel, his daughter, coming with the sheep. So, oh, and by the way, here comes one of your kinfolk right here. This is their daughter, okay? Verse 7, watch Jacob's response.
He said, behold, it is still high day. It is not time for the livestock to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go.
All right, so they're at a well, okay? Jacob is there. He finds out that one of his kindred is coming, okay, one of the people that it's potentially on his married list. We know from kind of fast-forwarding throughout the scriptures that all the patriarchs' wives are beautiful. Rachel is no exception. All these men are gathered at the well, and Jacob says, here she comes. Y'all hurry up and finish watering your sheep and then get out of here. What is he saying? Guys, you know exactly what he's saying. What is he saying? Yeah, I want some alone time. I want better odds, right? One verse one is good. One with 20 guys, like I may lose that. So y'all hurry up and get out of here. So he's being Jacob. He's being a little bit conniving, but he's trying to get some alone time with this gal so that he can get to know her. Okay, that's the idea. Verse 8, what do they say?
They said, we cannot until all the flocks are gathered together and the stone is rolled from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep.
So the problem is they got this big rock that's in the way of their watering hole. So while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came, verse 9, with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. Okay, make note of that. We've talked about that idea before, that it was the woman's job, the youngest daughter in the family, to take care of the sheep. Okay, this was a normative role for a gal. So as you think through the imagery of a shepherd in Israel, you need to think 10, 11, 12-year-old girls. That was the job description. Okay, so when a brother in a family had that job with sisters available to do that, it was an insult. Okay, so more on that later as we journey through our Old Testament. But she's a shepherdess. She's a hardworking woman that is doing the job of her family. Okay, verse 10.
Now as soon as Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob came near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother.
How about that? You think he's a little bit excited? I'll take this rock, move it aside, water some sheep. Okay. Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted his voice and wept. This was an appropriate greeting for family, so don't read too far into that. But he's basically saying, man, this is the gal. I am now connected with my family. So he's rejoicing that God is indeed taking care of him at this point on the journey. Okay? Keep rolling 12.
And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father.
All right. So they have talked. They've agreed on this. And now they're going to go back to tell Laban and Bethuel and the like that Jacob now is in town. Keep going.
As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. Jacob told Laban all these things. And Laban said to him, surely you are my bone and my flesh. And he stayed with him a month.
All right, so Jacob rolls into town, finds his family. Okay, he meets Uncle Laban, meets Rachel, obviously is quickly falling for this gal. We're going to see kind of in the progression of the text. And he's there for a month, just as a relative, okay? And then Uncle Laban has an idea, verse 15.
And Laban said to Jacob, because you are my kinsman, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be?
Okay, read between the lines, and what is Laban doing? He's got his cousin that just rolled into town, or his nephew, rather. He's been working for him, you know, on the family ranch for a month now. And he says to him, hey, just because you're a relative, man, you should get paid for doing all this really hard work that you've been doing for the last month. Tell me what you want. What are your wages? Name your paycheck. What's Laban doing? Knowing what we know about Laban.
Is he setting him up as a servant?
Totally setting him up as a servant. So what role is he in that he's trying to move him to? As he's currently working for free, why is he working for Laban for free? Because he's family, okay? He's not about to work for free anymore. What is he going to be? A slave, an employee, okay? The relationship changes quickly. I am now your boss. You are my employee. I will pay you. I won't pay you. But I have now control over you. So Laban seems to be making this very generous offer. Oh, man, you've been working for free. That's terrible. Buddy, I want to pay you, okay? Laban is, and I'm obviously at this point in the text, we don't see that yet. Laban is brilliant. He is the trickster, okay? He's going to out Jacob. And Jacob thinks, man, that's fantastic. Totally. I've been working for free. Now I get to work for money. He says, brilliant. Okay. So here's what he wants. Verse 16, what do you want your wages to be? And Jacob's going to tell him. Verse 16.
Well, Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel.
Okay, so we got two girls, Leah and Rachel. The older is Leah. Younger is Rachel. Rachel's the one that he met at the well that he's got the hots for.
Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful in form and appearance.
Okay, what does that mean? Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful in form and appearance. What does it mean that her eyes were weak? Oh, yeah, no, not that good. That's a good observation or good try. Yeah, that is a very politically correct way to say it. Okay, the eyes in this culture are a window to the rest of the soul, if you will. Okay, so to describe someone's eyes as weak means they're ugly. Okay, this is what the text is saying. Okay, she's older and she's ugly. Her younger sister is hot. Okay. So just to put it out there, okay? So who's the marriage material? Rachel, not Leah, okay? So it doesn't mean that she can't see. It literally means, and you see the contrast in the verse, right? In context, Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful. So the eyes have to do with beauty. She is not a beautiful young woman, okay? So sorry, I will apologize to Leah when I get there. I'm just telling you what the text says, okay? So Rachel's beautiful, Leah is not. Now Jacob loved Rachel, right? He's been there a month. He's completely, like, swooning for her. Like, man, I don't know. But he loves, obviously, the more beautiful of the two. So, typical dude. 18.
Jacob loved Rachel, and he said, I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel.
All right. So, what's the, you want a paycheck? Here's what I want for my paycheck. What is it? I want to marry Rachel in exchange for what?
7 years
of service. I will be your indentured servant for 7 years upon the agreement that I get to marry Rachel. Okay? Laban, let's sign on the dotted line here. Peggy, what's that? Read 19.
Agreed, Laban replied. It's too early.
More coffee.
Prefer to you than to anyone else. Stay and work with me.
All right, so your translation says something different than mine. Peggy, what are you reading out of? Okay, NLT. So mine says, it is better that I give her to you than to give her to another man. Stay with me. Interpret that for me. What does Laban say? Kinda. Is he clear on what he's going to do with Rachel?
No.
Not really. He's a little wishy-washy. He's like, yeah, that's a good idea for her to go be with you. And that's kind of where he ends it, right? So it's better that she's with you than another man. Okay, so are we in agreement here? So they make a bit of a pact, and I think it's assumed that, yeah, he's saying, yeah, I will give her to you as a wife. However, what's in the back of Laban's mind? You're a dad, you've got two daughters, okay? Who gets married first, your oldest or your youngest? Your oldest, always, right? You don't marry a younger daughter first, right? That would make it even more difficult for your older daughter to get married, but you marry off the oldest first. So what is Laban doing here? Am I going to give you Rachel?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. When?
Eventually.
After I give you Leah. So he's leaving the door open. You see how he's a little noncommittal? And we're going to see as the story progresses in these next verses, this is exactly what Laban's thinking. Jacob is too... She's so pretty. He's too enamored by her to even worry about this agreement. He doesn't see Laban tricking him, and boy, here it comes, okay? So, here we go. Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed him but a few days because of his love for her, right? It's twilight. There's this great story, right? It's just, it's ridiculous. So, he serves 7 years faithfully, thinking he's going to end up with Rachel. 21, Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife, for my time is completed, that I may go into her. I've served you 7 years. It's now time for Rachel and I to be husband and wife. And Laban says, super. Let's have a party. Let's have a feast. Okay? 23. Let's check out this feast.
But in the evening, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob. And he went into her.
I'm sorry. What? He brought Leah to Jacob, and Jacob sleeps with her. Hello? Like, what in the world is this about? So he gets the wrong wife and apparently isn't so sure that it is the wrong wife. Keep reading.
Laban gave his female servant Zilpah to his daughter Leah to be her servant.
Okay, so this is the handmaid that we've seen with other patriarchs or matriarchs rather. So this is not an abnormal thing. So she gets a maid to take care of her. 25 now, watch the rest of the story, the behind the scenes of how Jacob ends up with Rachel, or Leah rather, not Rachel.
And in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And Jacob said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? Did I not serve with you for Rachel? Why then have you deceived me?"
Now, need to read between the lines a little bit, and all of you get what's going on here. Okay, Jewish weddings are not an afternoon, they are a week. Okay, it's a feast, you feed people, it is extremely expensive. Ronan did this most amazing job as we were rolling through Cana, where Jesus turned water into wine, talking about the wedding feast and what it would have involved, the amount of money that a family would have had to pay in order to sustain this feast for 7 days. So it's basically a 7-day frat party, okay? It's a kegger, everyone's having fun, there's a lot of wine, it's a celebration. This is the entertainment, okay? So as that is the backdrop, at the end of this 7-day party, Jacob now goes into his tent to sleep with his bride, and he wakes up the next morning and goes, "Oh gosh, wrong woman." Are you kind of seeing a picture of where he is at in terms of his status at that point? Okay, I think the Bible would say hammered is where he was at. Okay, he is clearly not in his right mind where he would be sleeping with a woman and not sure who she is. Okay, so he is very well intoxicated at this point. Okay, you had a question, sorry. It's exactly what Laban's motive is. She knows she's got a beautiful younger sister. She probably hasn't had a lot of offers, and the one guy in town wants to marry her younger sister. So exact same motives. So she wants to get married just like any other single oldest woman would want to get married. Okay, so that's, she's, now she goes hook, line, and sinker with her dad, so we don't see necessarily a an ill heart with her. This is kind of Laban's doing, but she goes along with it because I think she realizes her options are few. Unfortunately, okay, that's welcome to the culture that we're in, okay? So, I think it's probably safe to say that he was hammered and did not have his wits about him, okay? And what does he say to Laban? Verse 25, read that again.
And in the morning, behold, it was Leah, and Jacob said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? Did I not serve you for Rachel? Why then have you deceived me?"
Why then have you Jacobed me? You did to me exactly what I would have done to you in that situation, okay? But you are a step past me in the school of trickery, right? Why have you Jacobed me? He got completely blindsided by this. Listen to Laban's answer, okay?
Laban said, "It is not so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week of this one, and we will give you the other also in return for serving me another 7 years."
So do you see how Jacob had thought he was getting, obviously, Rachel? Laban basically says, "Listen, I was never dishonest with you. I said I'll give you Rachel. That's a great idea. It's better for her to be with you than another man." So he was noncommittal, and he said, "I'm still going to do what I said I was going to do. I just gave you half of the information. So you get Leah. Complete the festive week, the bridal week for her. At the end of this week, I will give you Rachel as well, and then you will serve an additional 7 years for her. So you will now have put in 7 years that you received at the backside of that, your gift, which was Rachel, and then you're going to owe me an additional 7 years for Leah, Leah was first, then Rachel, which now he owes, he's banked now, to work for Laban for 7 years to pay off this bride. So he's getting two brides basically in the same week. So we've got basically a double wedding, okay? One guy and two girls. So that's how this is going to finish out. So after 14 years, Jacob will have both sisters as brides, and this is exactly what Laban wanted, okay? And he got hook, lined, and sinkered into this whole thing. So Laban says, "That's not our custom. You're going to serve me another 7 years," in verse 27. And in 28, Jacob did so, completed her week, and gave him as his wife. Laban also gave Bilhah, his maid, to Rachel as her maid. Okay, so as you look up at the chart, you'll see kind of underneath Jacob and his family, We've got Leah on the left that's going to have the kids that are listed underneath her, and Bilhah, who is her handmaid, okay? Then you've got Rachel and Zilpah, okay? So Rachel and Leah, obviously, are the wives. Bilhah and Zilpah, terrible names, but there you go, are the handmaids for both of these respective women, okay? He's going to have children with all of them, okay? So again, not ideal, but this is the situation that Jacob finds himself in. Meaning, well, there's two ways to look at this, okay? Some commentators would say there is a wedding festivity week, so at the end of that week of a party, then he got Rachel.
Okay.
So there's other commentators would say, man, do we see any time in Scripture where week is meant for the idea of years? We see that in the New Testament, especially with kind of our theology here at the Well in terms of end time stuff. It could mean that a week is actually means 7 years, as it does in future times. It seems most likely that it's just saying, look, you got the first bride, finish your celebration week with her, give her what she's due.
Oh, so it wasn't the end of that week.
Yeah, and then at the end of the week, then I'll give you Rachel, and then you'll serve me another 7 years. Yeah, so that seems to be what's happening. Okay, so he has two wives at the end of the week. He just owes now Laban another 7 years to pay for Rachel, okay? So Jacob went into Rachel, verse 30, and indeed he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban another 7 years, just like he was required to. So we got two wives. He's committed to be there now for another 7 years. And what do you see immediately in the problem, as a problem in Jacob's family in verse 30? Yeah, we've got two sisters, and there is tension between them, and it's about to get ramped up even more. So the first issue of the tension is, I love you, I don't love you. So, and, you know, that's kind of the reality that they're living in. So, speaking of Jacob, hello, Jacob. 31, let's pick up there and kind of watch how this family unrolls.
Now the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren.
All right, so again, same situation, right? We've got the woman that ultimately is going to be the most loved has a barren womb, and God opens the womb of Leah, okay? Leah conceived in verse 32 and bore a son named Reuben. Okay, so the firstborn son of Jacob's family, far left, is Reuben. Okay, verse 34, she has another son. His name is Levi. Before that, verse 33, Simeon. Verse 34, Levi. Verse 35, Judah. So the first four kids for Jacob are all from Leah: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah. That is the birth order. Okay, those four kids are going to be important. So just tuck those away as we read the rest of our story. So the oldest is Reuben, okay, then you've got Simeon and Levi, and then Judah, who's the fourth-born son. Now, obviously, as we talk about this idea of sovereign election, where does Judah fit in, right? He should not be the one that's receiving the blessing. Who should it go to? Reuben, because he's the firstborn kid. So we'll kind of unpack that story as to why he ends up being the guy that gets the lion's share of the blessing, okay? Now, end of verse 35, Leah has four kids. Nobody else has born kids yet, and she stopped bearing, okay? And I put a number above all those that you can look at. It's probably difficult to see in terms of birth order. So she stops having kids. Verse 1 of chapter 30, let's see now this tension continue to arise.
Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister and said to Jacob, "Give me children or else I die."
I mean, she's mad, right? Give me kids unless I die. It's like, and Jacob says exactly what you think when your wife says, "Give me kids unless I die." I'm like, look, we've tried. It's not happening, okay? And he says, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" Like, I can't open your womb. I can't close your womb. That's God's job. Like, why are you mad at me, honey? So he's completely stuck and doesn't know what to do. She says in verse 3, "Here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her that she may bear on my knees, that through her I too may have children." Okay? Think back to Hagar and Sarah and Abraham. What is this offer? What is Rachel saying? I can't have kids, so have a kid with my maidservant, and she will give birth to my basically adopted kid. She will give birth literally on my knees. I will be present with her during birth, and that kid will serve as my kid. I will adopt that kid, if you will. Okay, Jacob is being now offered this offer, which in that culture again would have been normal, and he says, okay. She gave him, in verse 4, her maid. He went into Bilhah as a wife. Jacob went into her. Bilhah conceived and bore a son to Jacob. Verse 6, he has Dan. Okay, so the fifth kid in the line of Jacob is by Bilhah, who's Rachel's servant. I may have said those backwards earlier. Rachel's servant, it doesn't necessarily matter, so don't panic about it, okay? But number 5 is Dan, and then she also has in verse 8, Naphtali, okay? Or Naphtali, however you say that in Hebrew, okay? Ronan will laugh at all of us when we get there, okay? So 5 and 6, from Bilhah, two more male kids, okay? Now, Leah wants a part of this action. When Leah saw verse 9 that she had stopped bearing, she took her maid, Zilpah, and said, oh yeah, Rachel, you got a maid, I got a maid. So Jacob, now you sleep with Zilpah and bear some kids. Jacob's like getting pimped out by his wives, right? This is a weird story, and it's odd, but this is the reality that he's living in, okay? So Leah's maid, Zilpah, now bears in verse 11, Gad. Verse 13 now has Asher. So underneath Zilpah, she has two male kids, Gad and Asher. So we've got 8 kids so far from 3 different women. Two are your wives. One is your wife, 2 are your concubines, or your servants, if you will. So odd story. Okay, it's about to get odder. 14, read that.
Now in the days of wheat harvest, Reuben went and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes.
What do you guys know about mandrakes? Janelle, what do you know about mandrakes? Nothing. You're a bad liar. You should all play poker with Janelle. You can take all of her money.
Nothing.
Mandrakes are they are believed to be an aphrodisiac. Okay, this would be something that would enhance the probability of having kids, enhance sexual pleasure. That is the idea. Okay, so Reuben goes out in the field and finds Viagra, gives it to his mom, and said, hey, can you use this? And Rachel says, well, I can, so how about you give me some of your son's Viagra so I can go into my husband? That's exactly what's happening here. Sorry to be so blunt. That's the idea. So these are in this culture, what is believed to be, they're like a fig Newton, if you will, okay? So that's the idea of a mandrake, right? So, but she says in verse 15, is it a small matter for you to take my husband? So Leah says, that's my man, okay? And would you take my son's mandrakes also? Like, no, that's my son's Viagra, so you're not going to take my husband and my son's Viagra. Sorry. So Rachel said, we're going to get through this. Therefore, he may lie with you tonight in return for your son's mandrake. So they're literally pimping out who's going to sleep with Jacob tonight. Well, he's my husband tonight. He's your husband tomorrow. I mean, this should be like a Discovery Channel show, right? It is. Verse 16, Jacob came in from the field at evening. Then Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come into me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrake. So he lay with her like, I bought your rights tonight. You're going to sleep with me tonight. I know you were supposed to sleep with Rachel, but I bought you. Like, this is the family of God. Like, what in the world is going on here, right? This is a disaster, but this is the family that God is going to bring Christ from, right? So aren't you glad that we all come from train wreck families as well? We're not the only ones. Like, good night. This is a mess, right? So he lay, verse 16, with her that night. God gave heed to Leah. Now Leah has more kids, as if she needed more. So she now has Issachar, Zebulun. Okay, the next two kids in line for her. So kid number 9 and 10, she has in verse 21, the only girl, the only daughter in the entire family. Verse 21, she has the 11th born kid, Dinah. Okay, the only girl, the only daughter of Jacob. Okay, by the way, when you end up having 13 kids, 12 of whom are male and one is a daughter, how do you think you would treat that daughter? Like a princess. Okay, so just keep that in the back of your mind. This is only daughter that Jacob has born to him by Leah. Okay, her name is Dinah. And we'll see more of her story as we move forward. Okay, she conceived and bore another son. Verse 22, this is important. Doesn't bore another, bears now first. 22, read that.
Then God remembered Rachel, and God gave heed to her and opened her womb. So she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. She named him Joseph, saying, may the Lord give me another son.
All right, so we have seen now 11 kids born to 3 different women, and then it says God remembers Rachel, opens her womb, and she has Joseph, okay? Anybody got a note on what Joseph means? What's that?
Mm-hmm.
May he add? What else? Anybody got another?
Sounds like the Hebrew for taken away.
Yeah. May he add or take away. Joseph's name either means addition or subtraction. It's a crazy idea. Now, why would that be important for a guy like Joseph? God has given Rachel what? A son. For the very first time, he is added. What's going to happen to Joseph? God's going to take him away, right? So it's prophetic of the life that this guy's about to lead, right? He is going to be the theme of the story as we get into chapter 37 and following. God gave this this humble woman a son, as she's now seen 11 kids born to three other women. God gives her a son, and then God is going to take him away. So a hard story, but that's she names him in a sense, in a very prophetic way of what will kind of be his life, okay? Now, that's what we've got so far. So we've got 11 kids, now 12 with Joseph. Baby Benjamin's coming, but he's kind of way down the road in chapter 35. We'll see his plight here in a bit, okay? Now, more on Jacob and Laban. So we've seen all these kids. He's been there now 14 years. He served for his family, okay? And Joseph, or Jacob rather, is going to come to Laban and have a conversation.
Now it came about that when Rachel had warned Joseph, that Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own place and to my own country."
All right, so what is, at the end of this 14-year period, what does Jacob ask for?
Go back home.
It's time for me to go home. I mean, I've been gone long enough, okay? My mom said, stay here for a few days until Esau's fury subsides. I've been here now 14 years. I didn't expect to be here that long, but here I am. It's now time for me to go home. And we're going to find out why he requests to go home in a bit, okay? So here's what he now asks with Uncle Laban.
Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me depart. For you yourself know my service which I have rendered you.
All right, so he basically says, hey, man, I've been good to you. You know the service I've given to you. Let me take my wives. Let me take my kids. And let me go. Okay, and then Laban makes a fascinating comment in verse 27.
But Laban said to him, if now it pleases you, stay with me. I have divined that the Lord has blessed me on your account.
Laban says, no, I'd rather you stay, actually, because I have divined that the Lord has blessed me on your account. Read into that for me. That word divine. Does that bother you at all? Yeah, why so, Stephen? Yeah. It doesn't seem like a consistent word to describe how God would interact, right? So are you telling me that Christians struggle with taking a little bit of God and a little bit of something else that's kind of God and kind of false God and putting those together and living that world? That idea of idolatry? Yeah. Welcome to who we see the first person to do it in the scriptures is Laban, okay? Now, this could literally mean, man, I've just kind of gathered. I've perceived. I've observe that my life is being blessed on account of you. It could mean that. It could also mean literally, no, I've divined through means outside of God's will that God's blessing me based on your presence, okay? Now, I'm going to take the latter with that, that Laban is an idol worshiper, okay? And we're going to see in context, I think that's a pretty safe assumption, seeing how Laban interacts with his family and some of the things that we're going to see that are normative in his family, okay? It's the first time we see this idea of divination, this idea of something outside of God combined with God, okay? And by the way, Israel's chief struggle for the next 2,000 years is this, syncretism, idolatry. Little bit of God, little bit of the culture, try to put them together and have a happy marriage, and it never works, okay? Punting God is not punting God. Punting God is taking 98% God and 2% of how the world views God and trying to put those together, okay? We have this kind of all or not mentality where it's like this, man, you're an atheist or you're for God. Man, when Christians fail, it's not because they abandon God. It's they take what they want of God and then they add and kind of try to click onto their Lego pieces what they think God should be in their own image. And God says, I will have none of that. Okay, this is who I am and you'll worship all of me or you'll worship none of me. But there is no kind of worshiping me. And this is going to continue again to be Israel's struggle for thousands of years, okay? And when you get to the land, this is when you see it. When we see, and as we walk Israel, and you get to see their history through their archaeology, it's a fascinating picture of how they struggled, for how long they struggled, just like us, okay? So Laban says, man, I'd like you to stay because God's blessed me. So he continued and said, name me your wages and I will give it. Sound familiar? Hey, Jacob, what do you want? I'd like you to stay. Whatever wages you would like to stay, stay, because you are my employee, okay? But you serve me. You've given me 7 for Leah, 7 for Rachel. We're square, but I want you to stay. Our old agreement's come to an end. Let's make a new agreement. Here's the new agreement. 29.
But he said to him, you yourself know how I have served you and how your cattle have fared with me. For you have little before I came, and it has increased to a multitude. And the Lord has blessed you wherever I turned. But now, when shall I provide for my own household also?
Now, what do you notice about Jacob's... Laban basically says, God's blessed me on account of you. And what does Jacob say? You're darn right he has. My presence has blessed you. Don't forget that. What type of servant, by the way? We're going to see a lot more of this in the text. What is Jacob saying about how he has served Laban? You yourself know how you have how I have served you and how your cattle have fared with me. You had little before I came, and it has increased to a multitude. The Lord has blessed you wherever I turned. Has he been a blessing to Laban in every sense? Absolutely. And we're going to see Jacob take a stand for his character here in a little bit in terms of how he's interacted with Laban. Jacob, this is not the Jacob that left Canaan with a bargain. He's been schooled underneath Laban. He realized, man, I'm going to spend 14 years now paying for the deceit that I tried to deceive Laban to marry his younger, not his older, and Laban schooled me. So he's been in the school of hard knocks for now 14 years. This guy's a man of character, and you're going to see him talk through that, what he's done, and even though Laban has not been, Jacob says, I have been a man of character as I've served you, okay? So he says, absolutely. So I've been a man of character. You indeed have been blessed. You see it. I see it. So he said, what shall I give you? And Jacob said in verse 31, you shall not give me anything. If you will only do this one thing, I will again pasture and keep your flock. I will stay if you do this one thing for me. 32.
Let me pass through your entire flock today, removing from there every speckled and spotted sheep and every black one among the lambs, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and such shall be my wages.
Okay, so what does Jacob ask for payment? Sheep. Yeah. What kind? Speckled, spotted, the black ones among the goats. Like, he asked for, of all the herds that they have, he says, man, the easiest way to distinguish this, let's take the ones that are solid. Laban, those are yours. Give me the ones that are speckled and spotted, which would, in that day and age, been the more rare, okay? So that would have been the minority of the sheep and the goats. And he says, just let those be my wages. Just, okay. Laban, understanding, listen, I don't know what percent were solid versus the ones that were not, but this was clearly, as your eyes would see it, in favor of Laban. Give me the minority of the sheep. Give me the lesser of the amount, and let's find a way that's very easy to visually distinguish between the two. Okay, so give me the ones that are spotted and speckled. Give me the, you know, give me the redheads of the family. Like, okay, like there's like, you know, you're the redheaded stepchild, as we all make fun of her, right? So that's the idea. So that's, give me the one that is the least likely to be reproduced in that sense, okay? So my honesty, verse 33, will answer me later. When you come concerning my wages, everyone that is not spotted, speckled and spotted among the goats and black among the lambs, if found with me, it'll be stolen. So you can just look at my flock, and if I don't have black lambs and spotted and speckled sheep, they're yours. I stole them, okay? So Laban says, good, let it be done. Done. Now watch what Laban does. Turd, verse 35.
And spotted female goats, everyone with white in it, and all the black ones among the sheep, and gave them into the care of his sons.
So he takes all of Jacob's sheep that they just bargained for, and what does he do with them? Gives them to his sons. Why would Laban be doing that? Why wouldn't he just give them to Jacob? Because he's a jerk. I say turd, but he's a jerk, right? He is. So he's decreasing the likelihood that Jacob can now be with them, have them reproduce, right? He's going to be there now another 6 years, we're going to find out, taking care of these sheep before he ends up leaving, okay? So it's an odd deal, but Laban's just being Laban. I'm going to give my agreement to you, your wages, and I'm going to give it to my sons, and they're going to take care of your sheep. So he's just trying to find every way to tip the balance in his favor, if you will. He's being a jerk, okay? He put them a distance of 3 days' journey between him and Jacob. So Jacob's sheep are now 3 days away. A day's journey, by the way, in Israel, the furthest you could go is about 26 miles, where we get the idea of marathon. So these are miles and miles and miles away from Jacob. He has no control over the situation. Okay? Verse 37, keep going.
Then Jacob took fresh rods of poplar and almond and plane trees and peeled white stripes in them, exposing the white which was in the rods. He set the rods which he had peeled in front of the flocks in the gutters, even in the watering troughs, where the flocks came to drink, and they mated when they came to drink.
All right, so he's got Laban's flock. He doesn't have his own anymore, so he's got all the flock that is not his, and the flock is now coming to the watering hole to mate. And Jacob does this really odd deal, okay? He's taking basically a line of trees, and he's stripping the bark off the tree so they look spotted and speckled. So they're mating in front of spotted and speckled branches. What is Jacob's hope? Yeah, it's just a little bit of like voodoo magic. I don't know what's going on here. There was a belief that maybe this would help, that, you know, if you saw something that was spotted and speckled, it would leave a mark on the embryo or whatever. It's an odd deal, but Jacob's like, we talk about the idea of lean on a shovel and pray for a hole. That's what Jacob's doing. Like, Lord, I need spotted and speckled sheep. You can provide that. I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure they're spotted and speckled, okay? So they're going to mate in front of these things that look spotted and speckled in the hopes that that's how they would come out, okay? Now, God obviously is behind this, and we're going to find out in a minute. The reason that Jacob asks for this is because God had revealed this to him previously in a dream. And he told Jacob, it's time to go. You're going to take your wives, you're going to take your kids, and you're going to take the spotted and speckled sheep. And we're going to find out God is going to take a family full of non-spotted and speckled sheep, and he's going to increase that number dramatically. So it should not have been the reality. So the minority is now going to become the majority, and that's going to be Jacob's pay. Okay. So God instructs him to do this here in chapter 31. We'll see that here in a minute. But that's what Jacob is doing. He's just trying to tip the balance in his favor as he's dealing with Uncle Laban the trickster. Okay. So 40, that's how they mate. 41, it came about whenever the stronger of the flock were mating, Jacob would place the rods in the sight of those. And when the weaker, you know, he's trying to selectively breed now. I want the strong ones to be spotted and speckled, not the weak ones. So that was the idea. Okay, so that's how he tries to ultimately bring about God's will in his life, by giving God a kind of helping hand because God needs it. Okay, 31:1 now. Let's watch the rest of this story. Ooh, so what's the attitude of Jacob's family towards Jacob, or Laban's family? That ain't good, right? It's Jacob's fault that we're no longer getting blessed. Like, oh, wait a second. Like, it's tense between Laban. Now it's tense between his sons. Jacob saw that the attitude of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly as it was before. Like, we were at least on good working terms. It is not good anymore. The Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and your relatives, and I will be with you. So, Jacob, it is time to go home. Okay, Jacob sent word to Rachel and Leah, brought the flock with him, and he said to them in verse 5, I see your father's attitude. It's not good anymore. We used to have a good working relationship. No mas. Verse 6, you know that I have served your father with all my strength. Yet, and listen to this, listen as he communicates to his brides how he's interacted for these last now 20 years. Read that in verse 7. So what does he say about this agreement that he and Laban had set up now almost 20 years ago? How has Laban handled it? Oh, yeah. We're in a recession. I'm going to need to cut your paycheck a little bit. Sorry, Jacob. Oh, you know what? I can't quite make pay this month. You're not going to get paid. 10 times Laban changes Jacob's paycheck, basically. And that wasn't a raise, by the way. It was like, oh, yeah, it gave me a bump, right? It gave me a 3% cost of living increase. That's not what's happening here. So he's being cheated by his uncle. And what does Jacob say about how he handled himself in the midst of that? Or how God allowed that to be handled? End of verse 7. God did not allow that to affect me. I stayed true to the course. The speckled and spotted shall be yours. Then all the flock that he brought were speckled and spotted. If it was said the stripes shall be yours, then that's what God did. God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. God has caused this calamity now to come on the house of Laban because of his dishonesty and because he's blessing me. Okay? God's taken all this away now. In verse 11, the angel of the Lord said to me in a dream. Now, this is previous to the story that we just read, But God is now, or Jacob is now telling Rachel and Leah, God came to me in a dream, and this is what he's telling them. Now, currently, the situation, but this occurred previously in the story, okay? Chapter 31, verse 11, pick up there.
Then the angel of God said to me in a dream, Jacob, and I said, here I am. He said, lift up now your eyes and see that all the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land, and return to the land of your birth.
So what does he see in his dream regarding the sheep and the cattle and the goats? Spotted, speckled, and matted. So he says, great, those are the ones that God wants me to take, so those are the ones I'm going to tell Laban I want as my wages. Okay, so that's why he chooses to do what he does. And then God says to him, I am the God of what?
Bethel.
What's the God of Bethel? What is Bethel? Why is that significant to Jacob? That's where I had my dream, and that's where God met me in the middle of nowhere. That is the house of God. This was 20 years ago. God says, I am the God that you made a pact with in Bethel. And that, again, that city is going to be extremely important, continue to move forward, but that is how God identifies himself to Jacob. Yeah, I think God's flexed with him at first, and I think he's going to continue to work that out of him. So I think he gives Jacob, it's like Abraham returning to Egypt. Not what I wanted, but okay, we can work with that. So is this a half-hearted attempt to follow God? Yeah. Is there a God if you? Yeah, okay. Well, let me show you that I'm going to hold up my end of the deal, and Jacob, let's see how you respond. So I think he's given him some room. So aren't you glad, right? Because we've all made stupid agreements with God, you know, or whatever, that God says, man, I want you just to follow me. But if you need these signs, these symbols, I think he's flexed with them, which is encouraging, okay? Rachel and Leah basically said, okay, God told you to leave. Do we even have an inheritance here anymore? Rachel and Leah said, are we not reckoned in verse 15 as foreigners by our dad? He's also entirely consumed our purchase price. Meaning what? Jacob gave a dowry for those brides, and what has Laban done with it? Blown it, you know? He got a plasma TV, you know, and a new car, and blown all of the inheritance that he was going to give to his girls on stuff that Jacob had given him for a dowry. Like, they're like, man, dad doesn't even love us. He's blown our dowry. He treats us if we're foreigners. Consumed, verse 15, our purchase price. Surely the wealth which God has taken away from our father belongs to us and our children. Do whatever you want to do. If God says go, then let's go. We're ready to go because it is as bad for us right now as it is for you, Jacob. So, man, let's go. Okay? So they decide now ultimately to leave town. Okay? Verse 17, Jacob arose, put his children and his wives upon camels. Verse 18, drove away with his livestock, his property, and all that he gathered. And he's heading now to out of Padan Aram to go to the land of Canaan. Okay? Verse 19, pick up there.
When Laban had gone to shear his flock, and Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's, and Jacob deceived Laban, the Aramean, by not telling him that he was fleeing.
So what does Rachel grab as she's leaving her house? Idols. Whose idols? Her father's idols, right? So what type of home did Rachel and Leah grow up in? Yeah, a little bit of Christian, a little bit of pagan. Let's put it together, shake it up, see what comes out, right? So she's used to worshiping God and worshiping idols, right? So this is a normative practice for her. So she takes, why would you take an idol when you're leaving town and never gone to this place that you're going before? Worship, what else?
Protection,
security, right? That's my whoobie, that's my binky, right? You're taking the things that are most precious to you. So what does that tell you about Rachel? Not totally, for sure, right? She's split, right? And that's what idolatry does. She doesn't hate God. She loves God. But she needs something a little bit more, right? She needs something that's going to really protect her, that she can touch and taste and feel and bring with her and hold and whatever, that's going to take care of her in this difficult trip. So she takes what she believes is most important to her, which are her idols, okay? Jacob deceived Laban and does not tell him about this dream and does not tell him he's leaving. So he flees, literally, in verse 20, we're going to find out. by the cover of night. Okay, Laban in verse 22 finds out that he had taken his wives, his daughters now, and they now are going to say, hey, that ain't cool. That's not how we're going to allow these guys to go out of town. And Jacob is now pursued by Laban in verse 23. And God now comes to Laban and speaks to him directly in verse 24.
God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream of the night and said to him, be careful that you do not speak to Jacob, either good or bad.
Okay, this is the word that Laban gets. What does that mean? What is God saying? Let him go, leave him alone, okay? Laban rolls into town, catches Jacob. Jacob pitches his tent in the hill country. These guys are faster. Laban says to Jacob, what have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword? That's exactly what Jacob had done. Jacob was told by God to leave. How should he have left? Laban, God told me that I need to go. I'm going to take what's mine, what we've agreed on, my wives, my kids, my flocks, and I'm going to go. Okay, you want to have a party first? Like, let's leave town. But he does it as if he's doing something dishonest. So he's deceived Laban. And Laban says, that's exactly what you have done. Now, it's odd that Laban would be calling out Jacob for deception when Laban is the deceiver, but that's what he's doing. Why then, verse 37 or 27, did you deceive me and did not tell me? I might have sent you away with joy and songs and a party, right? Like, really, Laban? That's how you would have done it? You'd have given me stuff and had a party for us? Like, come on. That's, you know, really? 28, did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. You have done foolishly. And in a sense, he's right. Jacob has done foolishly. He hasn't, he's trusted God to tell him to go, but what has he not trusted God for? The protection and the assumption that he'll take care of Laban. So he fears Laban at this point, right? More so than he trusts God. So he's like, man, we got to leave at night, okay? Verse 29, listen to what Laban says to Jacob.
It is in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful not to speak either good or bad to Jacob.
So what was Laban's intention upon leaving camp and chasing down Jacob? To do him harm. But God shows up and says, whoa, 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 time out. Cool your jets. Don't touch him. Don't do good or bad by him. Leave him alone. So he clearly states, that was my intention, and I have the upper hand. I have the power to do it. Your God has protected you from my hand. Now you've indeed gone away, verse 30, because you long greatly for your father's house. But why do you steal my goods? And Jacob says, pardon? Steal your what? Jacob said, man, I was afraid, for I thought you would take your daughters from me by force, the one whom you find your gods. I said good, sorry, gods. Why do you steal my gods? And he says, I was afraid. But he says, man, I didn't take any of your gods. I have no idea what you're talking about. In fact, if you find your gods against among any of my people and those who are traveling with me, he says in verse 32, what does he say? Thou shalt not live. So yeah, sorry, there it is. Yeah, so basically, kill him. Like, if I took something of yours, one of your idols, me or any of my clan, kill him. Like, I know nothing of what you're talking about. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. Verse 33, Laban sent basically word to Jacob's people, searches now all the tents to find his household idols, right? This idol that Rachel had taken. In verse 34, he comes into, in verse 33, Rachel's tent. In 34, look at the description of what's happening here. This, by the way, is a great commentary on God's view of idols.
Is it 34?
Mm-hmm.
Now Rachel had taken the household idols and put them in the camel's saddle, and she sat on them. And Laban fell through all the tent, but did not find them. All
right, so they're camping in the desert. He comes into her daughter's tent. She puts them underneath the saddle that she would sit on as her camel, okay, for her camel, and hides the idol underneath that. Laban searches the whole tent and doesn't find anything. And then in verse 35, listen to the commentary Rachel gives to her dad.
She said to her father, let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is upon me. So he searched but did not find the household idols.
The manner of women is upon me. That means exactly what you think it means. It's her time of the month. I can't get up and greet you, father, because it's my time of the month, and, you know, this is not 2015 in Fresno, and we have all the modern accoutrements that make that a little bit easier than it would have been 3,000 years ago. She says, oh, I'm not going to get up. And God is making, I think, a very clear commentary about how he views idolatry. Where do idols belong in the pecking order? It's exactly what it's saying. It's meant to be humorous. The value that idols have in God's mind is exactly that, right? It's funny. So she says, pardon me that I can't get up, okay? So she saves her own skin as a result of this. Jacob became angry now and contends with Laban in verse 36 and says, what is my transgression? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? Now, in these verses that follow, I want you to listen. Jacob is now going to defend his character at gunpoint, basically, to Laban, who came here to do him harm, and he's going to say, you find fault with me, and if you can find it, then deal with me. So this is a phenomenal story of how God has shaped him, and here's what's happened behind the scenes with Jacob. And this guy, he is leaving a changed man. Look at verse 38, pick up there.
These 20 years I've been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten the rams of your flock.
Now, what was Jacob's job with Laban? He took care of his sheep, okay? So your lambs have not miscarried, your ewes have not had issues, I have not eaten from your flock, I haven't taken anything of yours that wasn't mine to take, okay? By day, the heat consumed me. By frost, by night, sleep fled from my eyes. By the way, that's the life of a shepherd, right? It's hot in the day. It's cold at night. There's frost in the winter. But I have to protect the flock at all cost. These 20 years, verse 41, I have been in your house. I have served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock. And you have changed my wages 10 times. Now he has the courage to point his finger and thump Laban's chest and said, you have been dishonest with me. It is not me who's been dishonest with you. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been for me, surely you would have left empty-handed. It's my God that's prospered you, Laban, not the other way around. God has seen my affliction in verse 42 and the toil of my hands, and he has rendered judgment last night. So I left because of this, and I have been an honest and upright man. Verse 43 now. Watch Laban's response.
Then Laban replied to Jacob, the daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine.
And you read that right. Those are my daughters, my flocks, my children. Everything you see is mine. How does Laban view this? Man, he's got a completely backwards picture. He sees all this stuff as his, and Jacob says, oh no, none of this would be yours without me. So though Laban gives lip service to saying, hey, I see, Jacob, that you've been here and my life has been blessed on account of me, who's really the hero of the story? Me. My stuff, my daughters, my everything. And they have a significant disagreement as to who's in charge and who ultimately is the one to give credit to. So he says, regardless, we're gonna have to agree to disagree on this one, Jacob. So come now, verse 44, let's make a covenant. Jacob took now, in verse 45, a stone, set it up as a pillar, and they said, gather stones. They took stones now, and they make this heap of stones. And Laban, in verse 47, Jacob calls it Gilgal. And Laban says, this heap in verse 48 is a witness between you and me today. We're going to make an agreement. And the nature of the agreement is verse 49. Somebody pick up there. All right, so this is a witness between you and me that your God that you're speaking of is going to hold you accountable to. A, you're not going to take more women as wives other than the ones you already have that are my daughters, or God is ultimately going to punish you, okay? And what else in verse 52? I will not pass this heap to you for harm, and you will not pass by this heap as a pillar to me for harm. What does that mean? What are they basically setting?
Boundary.
It's a fence. It's a boundary. You will not come east of here, Jacob, living in the land of Canaan, and I will not come west of here or southwest of here into your land for harm. Now, you want to come for a Thanksgiving dinner? Brilliant. Come on, bring your family, and we'll celebrate together, which they're never going to do. But we're not going to have an uncordial relationship anymore, so we're agreeing not to battle one another. We're going to agree to disagree on this one, and we're going to move on. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, the God of our father, judge between us. So Jacob swore in verse 53, for fear of his father Isaac. So they make an agreement. They part ways, And now this idea of returning to the godly land to go get wives and to go get to meet with family, what is basically happening? What has God done? They've shut it down. So there is no more returning to Haran. So we're done, and we're now in the promised land, and we're living there. So you want to find wives? You got to find them from in town, no longer out of town, and you're going to have to live there. Okay? Verse 55, early in the morning, Laban arose, kissed his sons and his daughters, and blessed them. Laban departed and returned to his place in peace. Okay? So they kind of agree to disagree, part ways, but Jacob leaves with all his stuff, with all his wives, with all his kids, with all his concubines, and all basically ends well, but Jacob did not handle himself the way that he should have. He left deceptive, and you're seeing in him, he trusts God, kinda. He trusts God to a point until he feels like he has to step in and kind of help God a little bit. So those roots, those seeds with Jacob are still not gone. In fact, they're never going to be completely gone, but God's dealing with them, okay? Now, 32, let's pick up there, 32:1.
Now as Jacob went on his way, the angels of God met him. Jacob said when he saw them, "This is God's camp." So he named that place Mahanaim.
Mahanaim, yep.
And Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom.
All right, now let's stop for a second. So Jacob's left town. It's been 20 years, okay? He's dealt with Laban, and that's good. What is Jacob now worried about? Esau. How did he leave Esau? With a death threat, right? We're gonna mourn for dad, and when his time has come and he's died, we're going to have another funeral on the heels of that. And Jacob, it's going to be yours. And that's what caused him to leave town. And he's under the assumption that big brother is still hot mad, and he wants me dead. So what does Jacob do in verse 3? Sends out messengers. Why would you send out messengers? Go scope it out. Go tell me what's going on. Like, go find Esau. See if you can kind of figure out what's going on. So let's survey the situation before we walk into it blindsided. It's a smart move on Jacob's part. Okay. So, you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant: if you meet him, I want you to tell Esau this. I've sojourned with Laban now. I've stayed with him until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants. I have sent to tell you, my lord, that I may find favor in your sight. So when you go to meet Esau, what does he want told to Esau? I'm doing well, and I have a lot of what?
Stuff.
Why would you want Esau to know I got a lot of stuff? Because you can have it, dude. I'll write you a check. Whatever, you know, I got the means to pay you. I've got the means to make you happy. I can appease your anger. Okay? Now, verse 6, here's the message that he gets after his servants return.
The messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him."
Yeah, we saw him, and he's actually coming here with 400 dudes. We saw Abraham leave camp with about this many dudes to go get Lot. What was his intention when he left with 400 dudes? You ain't bringing women. You ain't bringing children. You bring up your boat up, guys, and you're coming to fight. So Jacob just hears, "Oh, son, I just told him I had a bank account with unlimited zeros, and he said, I'm coming with 400 guys. I don't care about your bank account. I care about settling a transgression now that's 20 years old. Okay, this is where Jacob wets his pants, right here. He's like, oh, doo-doo. So it is bad, and it's about to get worse. Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, I bet he was, and divided the people who were with him in half, the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two campaigns. Why would you divide your people? Yeah, we're going to split up the guys, and we're going to put some here and some there. Why would you do that?
Protect some.
He's going to kill all of some, but the rest will be okay. I don't know which, so let's divide it. We're going to play the odds. This is this is good marketing strategy, right? So one of these is not going to make it out alive. We just don't know which one, but the other half should be okay. So if Esau comes in verse 8 for one company attacks it, the other company can escape. So it's good logic. Do you see how scared he is? Yeah, just a little. Okay, Jacob said now in verse 9, first time we've seen this, by the way, in 20 years. Read that.
Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies.'"
Okay, and here's what he says.
Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children.
Now, listen to that. Deliver me, I pray, for I fear him. Not you. I fear him. And God, I need you to deliver me. What has God done with Jacob at this point? Where is he in his ability to control his situations?
He's pretty humble now.
He's pretty humble, would you say? Do you see God do this in your life? He certainly does it in mine. He has taken Jacob to the end of himself, and that problem is still very much there. And he says, Jacob, what are you going to do about that? All nothing? Because you can't do anything. You can't fix this situation. Your money, your means, your kids, your wives, all this blessing does not fix the fact that your older brother is hot mad and wants you dead, and he's been sitting on this grudge for 20 years. So God brings Jacob to a place, the end of his rope. He is broken. We're going to find out he's alone. When was the last time Jacob was alone?
Bethel.
20 years ago in Bethel. And God's going to get him alone so he can deal with Jacob. And in this place, what leads Jacob, by the way, to pray for the first time that we see in 20 years?
Fear.
Fear can be a very good thing, right? Sometimes it can lead us to make really poor decisions, but it can also lead us to go, oh, Lord, I don't know what to do. I am scared to death, and I realize I am at the end of myself, and I need you to step in. And God's going to step in a significant way. And he's about to show Jacob who's boss and who he really needs to fear, because it's not Esau. So he walks through this. I'm unworthy. You've blessed me. All this blessing does me no good if my brother's going to kill me. For you said I will surely prosper you in verse 12. God, you said these things. You said you would take care of me. We bargained 20 years ago, and I said I'd follow you, and you've held up your end of the bargain, God, so I'm following you. You promised this to me. So verse 13, he spent the night there. He selected from what he had with him as a present for Esau, and he sends in verse 14, 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes. I mean, he sends the partridge and a pear tree and everything else with it to Esau in droves. Like, he's just sending wave upon wave upon wave of groups of animals and gifts, okay? What's his goal? What's he hoping? I'm going to buy him off, right? I'm going to pray for a hole, and I'm not going to lean on my shovel, right? So, God, you got to show up, but I'm going to do everything I can to appease the wrath of my older brother. So he sends him all this stuff. He divides in verse 16 all the stuff of the hands of his servant, and he says, pass on before me and put a space between droves. So he kind of sends these again in waves. They come now to Esau, and Esau says, what do all these things mean that are coming my way? And in verse 18, he says, they belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present from my lord Esau. So Jacob has sent these as gifts to you. And by the way, end of verse 18, where is Jacob? Is he sending men and women and children and offerings to Esau? Behind us. Tell me about Jacob's leadership at this point. It's non-existent, right? So if Esau is still flaming hot mad and is the type of character that we saw he was 20 years ago, what has Jacob just done in terms of his wife and his kids? And he sent him off to be killed, right? He's marching them right off a cliff of like, hey, well, at least you're not going to kill me, so I'll send these first. They're expendable, and I'll let them go in hopes that that will appease the wrath of, wow, like this is not good leadership out of Jacob at this point at all, okay? So he's hoping that, again, Esau will chill out, okay? After this manner, you shall speak to Esau when you find him. In verse 20, behold, your servant Jacob is also behind us. So he's hoping perhaps that this will be an acceptable sacrifice to him, okay? But it's not. Now, 22, he arose that same night, took his wives and his maid and his children, those that were with him. They crossed the ford of the Jabbok River, which is just east. That's a river that flows into the Jordan River from the east, from literally the country of Jordan. And he took them and sent them across the stream. So he sends them, again, by themselves away. And in verse 24, Jacob was left alone. First time in 20 years we've seen this. And a man wrestled with him until daybreak. So all this blessing that he has, he sends them all away. Now it's Jacob, a rock, a desert, in nothing, just like Bethel. And by the way, he's just on the other side of Bethel from where he was 20 years ago. He's there kind of in that same region, but on the other side of the Jordan River. And he is alone. And who shows up in verse 24? A man to wrestle with Jacob. Like, what? 25, keep going.
When he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. The socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated where he wrestled with him.
So you've got this divinely inspired wrestling match occurring. And when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he, the man that has come to wrestle with Jacob, took his finger and touched the socket of Jacob's hip. That's the strongest bone in your entire body, or strongest joint, by the way, in your entire body. It's a ball and socket joint, right? It is very, very hard to dislocate a hip. And if you've ever met someone that did it, it is extremely painful, extremely hard to do, and extremely hard to put back together because of the nature of how our body's wired in that area. So he, with his finger, touches his hip and dislocates his hip. Okay, so you can clearly see who's got the upper hand in this battle. So this man, who we'll see who he is in a minute, is allowing Jacob to wrestle with him. It's a picture of this idea of prevailing prayer. Jacob is begging this guy, and we'll see in the text that follows what he's asking for. Okay, so Jacob will not relent with this wrestling match. 26, he won't submit, if you will. Keep rolling in 26.
Then he said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking."
And this is the angel saying to Jacob, sorry, ruined it. Angel that's now saying to Jacob, Jacob saying to the angel saying to Jacob, "Let me go." And Jacob says, "I will not let you go unless," keep reading.
"Unless you bless me."
Okay, so that's Jacob's desire. Man, I need a blessing. I need something outside of myself that's going to help me handle the situation. 27, keep going.
So he said, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." He said, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with man. And it prevailed."
All right, talk to me. Why is this significant, this idea of a name change? So this man, this angel that he's been wrestling with says, "What's your name, boy?" Right? And he says, "Jacob." And he renames him here, not Jacob, but Israel, which means, Israel literally means strives with God. Israel, El is God. Israel is to strive with, is the idea. So strives with God and have prevailed. What's the picture here? Yeah, this is, sorry, Stephen, keep going. Yeah, I mean, how many people got to do that in their life, right? He's literally, you know, he's in a headlock by the pre-incarnate Christ. This is the same angel of the Lord that we've seen throughout this story, and he's losing the battle, but Jacob will not relent until he gets a blessing. He realizes, "I can't fix the situation I'm in. God, please show up." God shows up, puts Jacob in a headlock, changes his name. And the angel finally says to Jacob, "Dude, let go of me. I got to go. It's about daylight." And Jacob says, "No, I've got a blown out hip, but I am not going to quit praying and begging of you to move on my behalf." And he now renames him Israel. And Jacob says, "Please tell me your name." You can imagine how this is going to go. "Why is that you have asked my name?" is his response. And he blessed them there. Look, you don't get to ask my name, right? I ask your name and I change who you are, but you don't ask the same of me. And he ultimately, in 29, gets the blessing. Jacob named that place Penuel or Peniel and said, "I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved." Again, every time you see an individual interact with this character, you see a similar pattern, right? How am I still alive? I am in awe. Who did Jacob... Yeah, and he got whooped too, which is, yeah, you're going to be in awe for a number of reasons. Who did Jacob fear walking into this chapter?
Esau.
And who does he fear leaving? This dude. "I should be dead." Perspective has just completely changed. He is now aligned to the right things. He is in fear of his life in an awe sense, not afraid of God. But again, he realizes who has the true power, and it's not Esau. It's this guy that he's been wrestling with all night long. Okay? Jacob renames that place in verse 30 and says, "My life has been preserved. The sun rose upon him just as he crossed the river. And he was limping on his thigh." 31, that's a great reminder. How does Jacob walk for the rest of his life? With a limp. Why?
Because pre-incarnate Christ dislocated his hip.
Because he had a significant interaction with you. Hello, Mike. We just read it. We had a significant interaction, okay, taking to the spiritual side, with God. And he left that time changed forever. And he walks with a limp as a reminder of wrestling with God in prayer in a significant spiritual moment in his life. Okay, there's been some great preaching done on this. Ladies, find a guy that walks with a limp. Literally, that has been spiritually dealt with by God, has submitted their lives to him, has wrestled with him, has prevailed with him. It's a cool picture of how Jacob lives the rest of his life. You know, so he rolls out of bed as an 80-year-old and his hip hurts. He remembers that every day, I guarantee you, as he's leaning on his cane and remembering the day, God won. He broke me, and I submitted to him. So he limps on his thigh. Verse 32, therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel don't even eat that part of the body of an animal because of the significance of what it means. Okay, so we've wrestled with God. We still got Esau in front of us. Verse 33, or chapter 33, verse 1. Let's kind of keep continuing as far as we can today.
Then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him.
So has anything changed? Nope, we got Esau. We got me by myself. We got 400 dudes. It's like, all right, it is what it is. I'm a sitting duck, right? It is all over, okay? Watch what he does.
So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. He put the maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last.
All right, so he lines up his family and realizes, okay, this is not going to go well. What order does he put them in? Favorite in the back, right? Put Rachel in the back with Joseph last. These are, you can see hints of favoritism in his family that we'll see exposed later on with Joseph. But he's saying, I'm going to put what I treasure most in the back. Verse 3, but he himself passed on ahead of them. How did Jacob lead last chapter? Everybody go first. I'll stay here in the back where it's safe. Okay. Now he lines everybody up and says, I'll take point. I will lead this charge. Now, if Esau's still Esau, what's coming next?
Murder,
right? Jacob's dead. Family's going to get taken, right? He's going to take his wife, his kids, and all that stuff, okay? However, the graciousness of God, verse 3, he comes upon Esau. Watch what happens.
3 or 4?
Read the end of verse 3.
But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother.
And how about that? Like, they're a ways off. You know, they're a football field across from one another, and Jacob gets up. Falls down and bows to Esau. Takes a couple more steps, bows to Esau. I mean, he's clearly saying, look, uncle, you know, mercy, please, anything, right? He's begging God and Esau to relent. Verse 4, how about this picture?
Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept.
Boy, you talk about a response that he wasn't ready for. What's been going on with Esau for the last 20 years? What has he done? Maybe, but is he hot, angry, mad with a sword in his hand killing his brother? No. What do you call this? Starts with an F and ends with forgiveness. He's forgiven his brother. Like, this hard, carnal, you know, hairy dude who wanted his brother dead has forgiven him. He runs to him. He embraces him. He kisses him. This hard Bear Grylls mountain man is weeping for his brother who he hasn't seen in 20 years. This is a powerful story. The guy that we thought would be least likely to forgive and to move on, forgives and moves on. Look at verse 5. Keep reading.
So he lifted his eyes and saw the women and children and said, who are these with you? So he said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant.
These are the maids. Okay, they come near. He shows them Leah in verse 7, the children, and Rachel, and he tells him the story. In verse 8, Esau says, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? You send all these things to me. Jake, what does this mean? And he says, I sent these to you, big brother, to find favor in your sight. Watch Esau's response. Gosh, the godliness out of this ungodly guy.
But Esau said, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own.
Like, what does he say? I don't want your stuff. Like, dude, I've forgiven you. You've been sitting on this and stewing on it for 20 years thinking I wanted to kill you. I'm done with that. That's in the past. Like, I don't need your stuff. God's given me plenty. I'm good. So what a crazy, weird, unexpected picture of forgiveness and a hard guy that we wouldn't expect to see it out of have a soft heart, move on, embrace his brother. And the rest of the story we'll look at next week. But it is a beautiful picture now of the forgiveness offered by the older brother to the younger, and Jacob not expecting this. So, boy, Jacob got what he did not earn, what he did not deserve, and what he did not see coming. He got grace and mercy in a situation that they were not merited or warranted to him in any regard. So, beautiful picture of the maturity now of Jacob and the embrace that he receives by his older brother Esau. And we'll pick up on the rest of that next week. All right. Guys, enjoy your Friday. We'll see you next Thursday.